You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriting. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. My guest for episode 51 is Andy Powell, guitarist and singer for Wishbone Ash. Andy was an original member when the band formed back in 1969 and has persisted through all of its 25-plus albums. You're right now listening to Blowin' Free, one of their big hits from 1972's Argus. Andy wrote the music to this one, while the main singer slash lyricist at the time was Martin Turner. And one of the ongoing pieces of drama with the band is that they have what's thought of as this classic lineup that was present for their most popular albums in the 70s. But that as the rest of the members left, Andy did not call it a day and pack in that name and make solo albums. He wanted to keep the spirit of that band alive, its dual guitar format, even though the identity of his partner, second guitarist, has changed several times then, as well as who plays bass slash lead singing. And while Andy had always done some of the singing, he became the band's sole lead vocalist somewhere around the mid-90s. To keep track of the various lineups and the various adventures over the years, one of the things I used to prepare for this interview was Andy's 2015 book, Eyes Wide Open, True Tales of a Wishbone Ash Warrior, though we also refer to another book that I read, 2001's Blowin' Free 30 Years of Wishbone Ash by Gary Carter and Mark Chatterton. Now, in our discussion, we talk about American Century from the 2014 Wishbone Ash album Blue Horizon, then look back to Master of Disguise. We hear the version from 1999's Bare Bones. The original version was from Just Testing from 1980. And then we will look back to before their first album, to Roads of Day to Day. It's a 1970 recording that was released in 2007 in a collection called First Light. And we'll conclude by listening to In Crisis from the 2007 album The Power of Eternity. For more information about the band, check out wishboneash.com. For more information about this podcast, check out nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you like what you hear, please support us at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will have played a little bit of Blowin' Free to remind folks of who you are, but I want to get pretty quickly to the new stuff, which would be the American Century from Blue Horizon 2014. Do you have any introductory words about that album and that song before we play it in full for the folks?
Well, I live in quite a historic part of Connecticut, and I've become interested in history just in recent years. I hated it at school, but of course, just through good fortune, lived in England, the first house that we ever bought, my wife and myself, was a 15th century cottage, and the beams and timbers of that building came from when they dismantled the British Navy after fighting off the Armada, the Spanish Armada, and then moving to this part of Connecticut. There are a lot of ancient homes by American standards, 400 years. We have a little town next to where we are. We're in Reading, Connecticut, and this town is Ridgefield, and they have a historic walk. And on the main street there took place the only actual battle against the British in Connecticut. That got me thinking, that little walk we did, and I was looking at these plaques on the walls and looking at the house where there was a British cannonball lodged in the wall. And it just got me thinking about just how recent American history is, and the revolution and the deep roots, in this particular part of the world with the British and everything that went down. And that inspired the lyric to American Century. The music was a different thing entirely. That came by, it was really an amalgam of ideas from several people, really, myself included. And specifically, the intro part and the recurring theme that comes through the song, that actually came from my son, Ainsley, who has worked with us off and on in a live context primarily, but he's also written a couple of things here and there with the band and for the band. So those are the key elements that inspired the music and the lyric to the song.
And Ainsley is primarily a drummer, is that right?
He's a drummer, a composer, amateur filmmaker. I mean, he on tour, he plays mandolin with us. He plays percussion, keyboards and guitar whenever needed. He's one of those kind of all-rounders that can fill in and perhaps more on a production role. But his real forte is drum set. So that's where he really shines. Well, we already have a really good drummer. So, and he has plenty of other things that he does musically in New York. So, yeah, I would say that American Century is probably one of the most proggy songs on the Blue Horizon album. We don't just limit ourselves to being a progressive rock band, but we certainly love to dabble in that kind of, I always find the term strange. I think most people that play in Prague find it strange too. But that, I would say, I don't know, I'm a big fan of the New Yorker magazine, and I was just fascinated this week to see that of all magazines, they covered the whole area of Prague and why it became successful and popular in America, you know, primarily obviously being the remit of many English bands from the early 70s. And it was just I really recommend it. It's a fascinating article as to why it took off in America and the nature of the audiences in America as opposed to, say, Britain, for example, and how they differ. And that is the most progressive rock track, I would say, on Blue Horizon.
Well, that's probably what attracted me to it. We're not going to do that for all the songs, but let's go ahead and play this one.
Thank you.
Yeah, so nice prog-like intro, including some kind of extra little jazzy bits. There's sort of two different intro riffs that you've got that thing that repeats the first time. Is that Aeolian mode, I believe?
Probably is, if you say so.
I had to look it up. I figured out what the scale was, and I looked up, okay, what's the one with the flatted sixth? It's not a natural thing for me to think in those terms.
It's not a natural thing for many people to think in those terms. I can tell you that.
But then when you actually play that a few times, then it does this twice in the song, this second bunch of intro riffs that has the echoing guitar. And so could you say a little bit how those things in a very practical way actually get put together? I know that you write a lot of stuff with dual guitars, and I've always wondering, is it one guy comes up with the riff and the other one just plays along with it in some way, or is it you kind of think of both parts in your head and dictate the other one to the other person, or does it kind of depend?
Well,
on
I think those two sections that you mentioned were conceived as one thing, mm-hmm. along with the bass line in point of fact. So they were composed, you know, in one go. In many respects, we're talking in general in the band, parts and pieces like that, they are composed and they come in different ways. I mean, sometimes you come up with one single guitar line and then harmonize in either fifths, fourths, or thirds mm-hmm. with it. But what often makes our music and those musical interludes in our songs interesting and perhaps different from, say, a band like Skynyrd or the Allman Brothers or something like that, is that the bass is not afraid to move against the guitars. It might be in a sort of contrapuntal way, you know, almost like a piece of classical music might be composed, you know, where the bass line might be descending against an ascending guitar line or two guitar lines. And that's what gives the music breadth, really. So you're actually composing, you know, and that's a really fun part of being in Wishbone Ash, is that with these very simple instruments, two guitars and a bass, forget the drums at this point because that's a whole different subject, but you're creating music. It's very broad, you know, and that's the beautiful thing about taking a little bit of time out to compose as opposed to just jamming, you know, and we love to do that too, that there is a good spot in our music for jamming in many songs. I mean, we're not afraid to become simplistic, but we're also not afraid to stretch out and flex our prog roots, you know.
And the reason I asked if Ainsley was a drummer, because those intro riffs, what sells them and what makes it so you can do them that many times and, you know, distinguish them from each other is Joe Crabtree's drum fills as he's responding to it, that he's just, you know, the first one is playing pretty straight and then mixes it up. And every single time this recurs, this intro riff in the song, there's sort of different interesting stuff that he's doing to throw the beat off.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting, and it's not the typical thing that you would think the drummer, a drummer would, in the way that he might punctuate it. There's a lot of tension and a lot of pushing and pulling with the drum fills. It's quite jarring, you know, in some ways, and that's kind of the intention, because the music is, at that point, it's meant to set you slightly on edge in the way that really echoes the lyric, really. And it's not until we get into the verse where it's like you breathe a big sigh of relief, because then you get into this little bit more four to the floor mm-hmm. kind of typical rock groove. And it's that catch and release thing with our music, the dynamics, that I think sets bands like ourselves aside, because we understand and we know that audiences love that. They love to be teased and they love to be taken on a journey. And they love that release when it just goes into the groove and it becomes that rock. So I think, you know, with bands like ourselves, we're hit in the head and the heart, really.
Well, I wonder about the mixture of different ambiances that are suggested by the tones here, because you've got this intro has a certain old English folk kind of thing, but then it has a couple blue notes that brighten it up in interesting ways.
Yeah.
But then when you get to the chorus, it's this bum, bum, you know, this very military kind of triumphant thing, which, I mean, do you think about these connections in terms of, like, I wouldn't have necessarily, I guess now that I say it, I can picture this intro as being the intro of some kind of military song, but not really. I mean, normally that would kind of connote just a more straight, like, let's do drum rolls or something, you know, kind of do a march and get into it.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that would be the obvious thing to do, but I think the sort of strident military thing kind of hints at the element in the lyric that deals with that military aspect and clashes of armies and so forth and colonies, you know, rebelling and all the rest of it. But yeah, you're right. It's got the blue notes in it. It's what I like about the intro figure is the fact that the guitars are very clean, you know, and we're not afraid to turn down the distortion and just get a bit pure, really, with the sounds and the tonally, you know, which I like, because in that way, the melodies and the time signature really is what carries the composition. You're not depending on too much distortion and ear candy to kind of get the idea across. It's really in the composition. So it's really quite pure in that respect.
Well, and it's like you said, that for that initial figure, you don't even need drums at all. And it reminds me of those particular like Steely Span or Fairport Convention sort of riffs there. But then having the jazz drums answer that, you know, adds this extra dimension that I haven't heard that kind of combination exactly.
It's wild. I think at that point in the album, we were like, let's just throw some stuff against the wall and have some fun here. You know what I mean? But you're absolutely right about Steely Span or Fairport. I mean, Fairport Convention was one of the first real bands I saw. I think I was about 17 or 18, and I saw one of their first shows at a festival. And they really inspired me because for the first time, you know, there was a band that wasn't afraid to show its English roots and its Englishness, but in a rock context. And it really excited me that, because, you know, a lot of music at that point in the late 60s was coming out of California, bands like The Dead and those kind of bands, you know, I like the West Coast sound. I like the way that they use vocals. And so, but here was Fairport Convention doing their own thing, which, you know, it was obviously folk rock. And that has always been a really firm aspect in the roots of Wishbone Ash. And it's something that I think gives us that differential between some American bands of the same era and even now, you know, where, you know, the roots obviously are to do with blues and folk sometimes in America, but more specifically blues, I think, is a stronger, and jazz, you know, roots in American popular music.
I noticed one little arrangement thing toward the end. It sounded like when you get into, I heard it distinctly in the second verse, I'm not sure if it happened in more times in the song, the bass is doing a pretty straight ahead eighth note thing. And it sounds like you've got guitar like an octave above that, just doubling that. So is this extra overdubs that you're not really trying to particularly make something that you can exactly reproduce live? You're just kind of building out sounds as they need to be, you know, to thicken the sound?
Well, yeah, you know, you're creating a sound palette. That is the kind of thing that you do have license to do in the studio. I mean, of course, you don't want to be taking it too far because in the event of reproducing the song live, you know, you've kind of got to recreate that. You've only got so many instruments. But, you know, in the studio, we can take a little bit of liberty and reinforce a bass line. There are tricks like that, for example, with bass guitar. The Beatles did this, you know, where you can add a piano playing exactly the same notes as a bass guitar. And that's a wonderful combination. So, yeah, we'll be doing that with guitar. Sometimes we will just play an octave higher in unison with the bass. That creates its own color texture at that point.
Well, and one thing that kind of surprised me about that is, you know, certainly not uncommon to have the rhythm guitar doubling the bass, but it's not ever just going in a clean sound, bum, 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 bum. It's, you know, so
yes.
It would be perfectly acceptable in that verse, given that you're opening things up and it's entering this warlike thing, to put some grunge or at least some power into some, maybe not a full chord, but at least the one and the five, you know, that not simply double the bass, to make it more obvious if you're going to do it.
Yeah, possibly so. Well, you know, I think that Wishbone is not always an obvious band. One of the things of Wishbone Ash is that perhaps if we were more obvious at certain points with our music, we would have had success in certain quarters, perhaps a little bit more. But, you know, that's not always the case.
I've listened to the mid-80s albums. I know you tried.
We tried and failed, in my opinion, because I think that we can do it. You know, I mean, albums like Twin Barrels Burning and so forth, I mean, we can rock out. But I mean, for me, being, if you like, the keeper of the light, the holder of the flame, you know, I've looked long and hard at this, and I've seen that really we're not an aggressive band. We're just an English band. And I think that, you know, when we play to our strengths, which is using those kind of church harmonies and folk roots, you know, I think that's when we score a little bit better. I feel, anyway. The people in Wishbone Ash over the years, the various members, certainly the original members, Martin Turner, myself, I mean, we all grew up with English country dancing, with English folk melodies. All kids in Britain at that time, and certainly in the 50s, you know, it was part of the curriculum, actually. And then, you know, you were sent to Sunday school, you would listen to these hymns, you know, it's a great tradition of English hymn writing, and that just comes out naturally. It's your roots, you know, it's the way you hear harmonies, and you don't always naturally go to the third, you might go to the fourth. You can hear that in progressive rock bands that came out of Britain in the early 70s and late 60s.
Well, one of the things that nicely brightens it up is that female backing vocal that comes in the chorus echoing, which just this little burst of sweetness that sort of not exactly what I would expect again in this is military breaking free. I mean, it definitely works.
Well, you know, women were a part of those conflicts and they were often in the background sweeping up the wounded and tending to that. So that was a stroke of brilliance, I think, by our drummer, Joe Crabtree, who added that element in. And indeed, we were recording the album at the studio in his house. So he was able to sort of add that. And with a piece of music like American Century, you know, it's kind of like creating a recipe. You can just add different ingredients and it just changes the flavor subtly. That's the interesting thing about a song like that, that you can have fun with production elements like that.
And one other little section I wanted to highlight, getting out of the chorus back into the riff. It's kind of a flutter of stuff there under the violins that you've got. It's not just that you're blasting through the same chord until you stop, that it goes through a quick three chord change. Where would that kind of thing come in the process? Would that just be as you're actually getting down to lay it down and figure out like what makes sense here?
We're always looking to reference themes. You wouldn't say bring a theme in like that at the beginning and never refer to it again. And then, you know, there will be discussion in the compositional stage as to how we were going to reintroduce it again and wrap the whole thing up. And so, you know, these are kind of like intellectual conversations that you have. You know, you're not just in a studio, you know, or a room just jamming this idea. You might have an instrument around your neck and say, well, what about if we built it to that climax there and then just came back to the theme? Now, that's different from, say, a song like Phoenix, which has been a stalwart song in our repertoire for many, many years, which very much did come from jamming. I mean, we don't have the luxury so much these days as we did in the early days where we were all living together and playing and jamming out in a basement for literally 12 hours a day, because we were trying to craft and trying to produce a band, trying to develop a band and a sound. You know, these days, I mean, we've got people living on different continents. I mean, a drummer lives in LA, I live here in Connecticut, and then, you know, our bass player is in London. So we very often get together on a tour and we're rehearsing songs as we go along just by the sheer restrictions of geography, you know. You tend to verbalize things, plan things out. You're working at arm's length with each other. So when you get in the studio, it's a kind of a discussion more than a jam. But that was deemed to be the best thing to do at that point in the song. At that point, you're a collective and you're voting as a committee. And certainly with a song like this, it's very much music by committee. It's like producing a movie, really.
Well, and that just, it seems a key part because you're never going to have that same effect as the first time it's introduced because rhythmically, it's set up just to screw with the listener because really the first note is a rest. It's rest, da, 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 but nobody is going to hear the rest. They're just going to hear, and then they're just thrown off by what, an eighth note where they think the measure is supposed to actually start. It's just the fact that the whole thing is pickups.
But you know, English guys love all that stuff. We love to mess with your head. That's just us fitting pieces of the puzzle together and just having fun and trying to pull you up sharp. It's not music that you can just ignore and like have it on in the background and go, oh. I mean, I was listening to some rap music today and it just went along on one chord and the guy was doing some interesting stuff with the rap time signature and the rhythmic element of the vocal. But, you know, the groove is just, it just goes by. It's just one stream, you know. But this stuff's designed to pull you up sharp and make you listen to it and go, what? Wait a minute. What did they just do? Let me run that back, you know. It takes you a while to get comfortable with it. That's not all songs on the album. I wouldn't want to do an album like that. But this one, like I say, we were definitely having some fun with.
Well, and this one at least just kicks you once, whereas that technique, I know the Police did it, where you've got a beat in it that's on the offbeat. Some pop-um, 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 pop. But you don't play the one. You just start with the pop, pop, and then it's only after a few measures when other things come in and everybody realizes that they're turned around.
Yeah.
I like it, but it bothers me.
So it makes you unsettled. Yeah, I think I would go along with that. But the lyrical theme is unsettling. It's an unsettling thing. I know exactly what you mean. I mean, you know, if you listen to old blues singers, sometimes they're like, they're turning a beat round. You know, they don't play an even number of measures. They'll do like a 12-bar blues becomes an 11-bar blues, and that can really mess your head up. And you're right, the Police did that stuff a lot to trick you. It wasn't always comfortable. Sometimes it was, but bands like Gentle Giant, they made a whole career out of that.
Sure, sure. Yes, also with the very kind of restrained Baroque sound that you're talking about, typically yeah. not bashing you over the head in terms of the sheer volume or...
Right.
This seems a good moment to get to the second song, which does not display any of what we've been talking about in terms of
right.
trickery, the arrangement itself. So this is Master of Disguise. It originally was on the Just Testing 1980 album. The version I wanted to play was from the Bare Bones 1999 album, to kind of hear you sing it and hear your more recent interpretation of it. And it's just a very nice, tasteful. It's got even organ things, you know, violin things that are not even associated generally with Wishbone Ash, but that come in to just warm things up and make it a nice kind of classic song.
Thank you.
I know this was your first solo writing credit. Do you remember anything about what that was like or some other introductory words?
I actually had written other songs pretty much completely, like Errors of My Way, you know, was my song. But in those days, we didn't credit individual writers. Even if you wrote a song, it was credited to everyone. Things like Ballad of the Beacon was mine. But you're right, because other members were pushing for individual credits, I thought, okay, well, that's it then. I wrote this song. So thank you for the critique there. I do like the Bare Bones version, actually, very much. And I sometimes play in little coffee bars locally here in Connecticut. I'll sometimes whip that song out and play it in that manner. But it's a song that's quite dear to me because, you know, I'm an immigrant, really. And I know that's hard. Sometimes, you go to another Anglo-Saxon speaking country like America and you think, well, it's just going to be another different version of England. And in point of fact, it hit me very quickly that America is vastly different to England. And it's a different mindset, even though the language on the surface seems very similar, but it's not at all. And the way that language is used in this country is different. It was my way of trying to catalog what it was like to try and assimilate into the culture. Americans generally have a fondness for the old country. They welcome you with open arms. But you still, nonetheless, you know, you go to a city like New York City and you walk down Fifth Avenue. I mean, Sting's song, Englishman in New York, which was a later song, kind of deals with that. You realize that there's so many aspects to it that you have to really pull your socks up and get really involved with the culture. And some British people don't ever do that because our culture is so strong that they feel that everyone else should bend to their will. And I realized if I was going to make a career here and stay here and live here and bring a family up here, I better assimilate quick. And so I made it my business to understand what it was. And the song Master of Disguise kind of talks about how you really keep your own culture somewhat buried. You flash it at certain points, but things are not quite as they first may seem. You really just let out who you are in just little flashes, but you make an effort to assimilate because it's much easier to do that. You know, you can't go into a store and say, if you want somebody to get something down from a shelf, could I possibly have would you mind terribly possibly if you would just bring that down off the shelf? And, you know, or, you know, if you're asking for directions, you just... If you do it in the English manner, people are going to go, get to the point, buddy. You know, so you start using Americanisms. And so the song deals with that. And it's not a negative. It's a positive thing, actually, because in so doing, you do learn what it is to adapt. The final verse of the song, it says, so you'd like me to reveal all that I know and feel, and at the risk of causing panic and destruction. Well, you know, there are times when you have a very broad worldly view and you might be at a dinner party or you might be in a bar or a pub and you learn pretty quickly as musicians. A lot of musician friends of mine learn this, that you really don't want to start spouting off about how it was to be in Paris last week and how 3 weeks ago you were in Barcelona, because it makes people uncomfortable. I mean, on the one hand, they love to listen to your travel tales, you know. But on the other hand, it stops you being a part of the group and you want to fit in and you want to feel comfortable if you're discussing what went on in the news or something like that. So all of that comes into the song and it's very much a philosophy that I have in terms of being in a foreign country, period. It's just nice to shut up some once in a while, just listen to what's going down around you and you learn a lot, you know. It's great.
Mm-hmm. I'm a master of disguise, a mystery in your eyes, traveling the back roads of your country. While you think you've got my number, but then again you wonder, will you ever get to find the real me? Things are not always as they first may seem. It's like living in a dream. So you'd like me to reveal all that I know and feel, at the risk of causing panic and destruction. There's a method in this madness, I don't mean to cause you sadness, but my course is strictly governed by instruction. Things are not always as they first may seem. In a dream.
So the difference between the old version and the version we just heard isn't as stark as one would think, given, you know, that this acoustic nature of this album, that you have full drum kit. It was an acoustic guitar the first time. I mean, we don't have wah-wah guitar all over the place. We have different solo instruments again. Say something about the, I know it was just a lot of people were doing unplugged albums, and this was your contribution. It was a fairly easy way to get some new songs that are pretty good, and then be able to rework things, especially like this, that you didn't get to sing the first time. But say a little more about that process and why this one was picked and how you thought about the changes, why violin got in there and other things like that.
It's in one of my favorite keys, with it, which is F sharp minor. I've written a few songs around that because it relates nicely to the chords of A and E and D. And it's very easy to sort of, you know, if you play F sharp minor and you have the, I don't know what the technical term for the chord is, but you have the B and the E ringing out against that F sharp. It gives it this kind of open, transparent sound to the music.
It'd be an F sharp 13th, I believe, right? It's the suspended fourth and the seventh.
So, yeah, that's right. And so it was the way that I actually kind of heard the song when I first put it together. And I've used those chords in other songs, like Underground is a song of mine that has a similar key signature.
I'm a master of disguise.
mystery in your eyes, traveling the backgrounds of your country. Where do you think you've got my number? Then again, you wonder, will you ever get to find the real me? Things are not always as they first may seem. It's like living in a dream.
And so, you know, it rolls along, you know, it's a nice thing to pick on an acoustic guitar. It's kind of the way I kind of envisaged it in the beginning. And then it gets into this kind of little, which is typical for Wishbone Ash, we go into this little Baroque piece in the middle, and you're right, the fiddle comes in. And again, the Celtic roots coming out, and it's something that we've explored quite a lot recently here and there, bringing fiddle in. But that was quite an early attempt at bringing fiddle in. And I always felt that songs of ours like Errors of My Way and some of the lines that we did in other songs would have benefited from having a third part, a fiddle part. These days, it's not uncommon to bring electric violin into rock.
Sure, put distortion on it. You don't even know the difference, maybe.
Well, that's absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, so many guitar solos sound as if they are almost like a fiddle, you know. So it's quite natural, really. But this one's more purist. It was a really enjoyable way to kind of present the song.
And so what made you, for instance, add this prominent organ part? That's not even an instrument that's in the band normally.
It's not difficult to just pull out a few chords on an organ, you know. And with a song like this, you want a color change at mm-hmm. some point. Again, it's as we were talking about with American Century, but applied in a different way, where if you bring in a different sound palette at a point in the song, and the organ's an easy way to do it, suddenly the whole thing goes from jangly to warm. And that's a dynamic shift in the music. And on a production level, I mean, that's the hip thing to do. And we use that technique in pretty much every album we do. I mean, obviously, we are not going to be playing organ terribly much on stage live, although we brought it in from time to time. But it's great to have fun doing that in the studio, and anyone in the band can play those kind of simple chords.
So by extension, I guess the biggest change in this from the other version is the break, that it's about a minute and a half in, and it's actually, it seems like a totally different riff than is in the original version, that it's got this very, it's, I guess it's just two guitars, but it's got this very harpsichord feel.
That's me double tracking, but you know, it's like standard guitar initially, and then the harpsichord effect is achieved by using a Nashville tuning on a second guitar, which is just basically taking the 12-string set of strings and taking the bottom strings off, and then playing that simultaneously with the original guitar.
Have you tried? I've also done the make a copy of the guitar track and then put an effect on it to, you know, the octaver effect. Add that little extra shimmery. It's like a fake 12 string.
Sure. Yeah, you could do, I've done that, but this was, I wanted a more organic approach. So I just physically did it. You know, I'm glad you picked up on that.
Yeah. And then we actually do get the rolling snare part. That is this is not a military song, but we get this violin almost suggests fife kind of, you know, in terms of that.
Yes, it does. It does. And our drummer on that album was Ray Weston, who is actually, in fact, Scottish. That comes very natural to him, you know.
So, okay, maybe even in the military tradition, the fife is what you'd associate with New England. But if you're doing that exact same kind of war song, you might have violin or something else like that in Scotland. I don't know.
Yeah, there is.
So this is Morwenna Lasco, is that right? Doing the violin parts here?
Yeah, well, Morwenna was my son, Ainsley, who we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. It was his girlfriend at the time. And she's a pretty fine fiddle player.
Do you know, was she coming at this with a folk background?
Yeah, she definitely comes from a folk background, most definitely.
I've played with a couple different fiddle players, most of which have classical training. Like, that's how you get fiddle training. But that, to actually call it a fiddle and do those bends, it's a whole different...
Yeah, it's very definitely fiddle lines, definitely. And that's the roots, yeah.
So then we get to the end of the song, the Out in the Night, in the Cold, Cold Night, which it seems like it's much more emphasized on the original version, that it's kind of here, it's just like a little tag to fill things up after you've been having violin solo for a while, whereas And the original version is kind of this more epic, I don't know, frightened thing.
Yeah, maybe we made too much of it in the original version. And this is, you know, that's more like the reflective part of the song where you think, hey, you know, being an alien can be, it can be a bit scary as well, you know, in the cold, cold night.
What do you think in terms of the way that the band interpreted it originally, that it certainly doesn't sound like what you described as the story of fitting in? It's kind of a, there's no crisis going on. The original version makes it sound kind of more paranoid, and maybe it's the way Martin is singing it, or just the having all these crazy wah-wah things going in.
More crisis, I think that's a good way of putting it. And I think that, you know, we were in crisis at that point because we'd had some negative experiences coming over here. We'd been thrown in with some business people that we weren't comfortable with. And maybe that was the way that Martin was interpreting it. And, you know, the thing is about a good song is that you can interpret a song in different ways and you can bring those elements to it. And I think that that was the way he heard it and the way that he felt it. And he, of all the people in the band, felt the most alien being in America. He did not. It did not sit well with him coming to the States, and he mentions that in his interviews and books and so forth. And I think that's why the song resonated with Martin. With myself, it was probably a little bit more of a benign experience, and that's perhaps why on Bare Bones, the album, it comes across that way. It's a little bit more reflective and whimsical, whereas his interpretation, enhanced by Laurie's wah-wah and so forth, gave it that more anxious, angsty kind of edge, you know?
Just looking at the lyrics in front of me, you know, it brought to mind some of the sections of your book where you're talking about the fans and how some of the fans can get a little extra creepy. And a lot of it suggests I'm traveling the back roads of your country. In other words, it's your touring around that area. And the way that you're interacting with most of these Americans is you're standing in front of them and performing for them and having this weird relation of audience to thing that they're supposed to all just stand and stare at, which is not necessarily a way to get at the real me, or, you know, that sort of alienation that comes with that. That was not on your mind in writing this?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, all of that I think was on my mind as, you know, in addition to trying to fit in to a new culture. And I'm not just thinking about America, you know, but you have to also build a force field around yourself because you're very vulnerable until you can figure it out. It takes you years actually to figure it out. So you build a force field around you, yourself. And, I think there's a dichotomy there. I think that you're working the two aspects, you know, it's like a, you know, I always talk about this with people in business, for example. They have a public face and they have a private face. I mean, politicians are the ultimate example of that. But make no mistake, musicians do the same thing because you get privy to a lot of information and you go through a lot of life experiences that are pretty wacky. And much of it revolves around travel and much of it revolves around cultural things, you know, blending in with other cultures or exploiting yourself in a different culture. And there's a reason, for example, I mean, many bands find that they're successful in different countries for reasons other than what they were successful in their own country. And you have to adapt to that. And again, it's not necessarily a negative thing. It's just giving yourself some breathing room, some wiggle room to figure it out. And that's what the song's dealing with, you know, and I think that's why it bears revisiting as we did on Bare Bones in a different way. So, you know, I think that's the mark of a good song if it can be interpreted freshly in different contexts.
I ask this next question, by all means, do not take offense. This is a matter of what you're thinking about when you're writing lyrics and how you deal with when you're in a band with other people that write lyrics. I know I've run this before, you know, so this chorus, things are not always as they first may seem. It's like living in a dream. Now that captures very well what you've described. And I think it works very well in the context. On paper, that looks like a horrible cliche in terms of living in a dream. Like, so is that the kind of thing that, like, do people even in the band pay attention to each other's lyrics? Like, I know Roger Waters talking about Pink Floyd, like, part of the reason he was able to do all the lyrics is because the other guys just didn't care. Or, like, if it wasn't your song, like, they're not going to police each other in that way. But it sounds like you guys were more hands-on.
We did all of that, and sometimes we would police each other's lyrics, especially in the early days. And then other times at certain phases within the band, we wouldn't care. But, you know, that song was written a long time ago. I mean, you know, we're talking
Yes.
30 plus years. So you got to make a little excuse for it there. But I think that sometimes these songs are written really quickly as well. You know, I mean, that one I know was written really quickly. But sometimes, you know, the feeling and the spirit, even with a cliche here and there, it comes across. Some of the best things are written really off the cuff like that. You know, other things you spend a lot more time thinking about. You develop them. You might have a lyric lying around for 3 years before it sees the light of day, you know. You come back and you tweak it and you visit it. But, yeah, I mean, certainly we would police a lot of things in the band. I mean, we'd be policing guitar riffs. We'd be policing bass lines, drum fills, and certainly lyrics.
Are there songs where, you know, I know there are some of my songs from 20 years ago or whatever that I'd like to play that live with the band, but I would have to rewrite at least those couple of lines that just grate on me. Like I would, that there's, it's too cliche or just doesn't work. You don't have the right to do that because it's all on record and people will think that's weird.
But trust me, we've made mistakes on record and there are certain songs that I just flat out wouldn't play live.
Sure, sure. I mean, yes, you can abandon it when you like it otherwise. Like, have you gone back and reworked anything from that perspective? Or it's just like, no, it's, the lyrics are what they are. It's fine.
We move on because, you know, we have album deals and we are always like patronized to produce a new album. But certainly there are songs I'd like to go back and rework. And maybe that's something for my dotage, you know. But certainly there are songs in the catalog that I probably wouldn't touch because of maybe corny guitar line or maybe a misogynistic lyric or something that I just couldn't back up, you know, even if I didn't write it, I couldn't espouse it. I couldn't support it. And that does happen. I think it happens with all bands, really.
So maybe this is the time to transition to the third song, which is going way back, Roads of Day to Day. I'm glad you agreed to do this one. I wasn't actually sure. You're the one that revived it. So this was originally recorded in 1970. Before your first album, the tape was found and remastered or actually remixed. I'm not sure. Released in 2007 for the First Light album. Was this a full group composition?
No, I think it's pretty much 90% myself.
Okay.
I think. I mean, I'll get slightly embarrassed with this one because it's such a charming, youthful, naive song. And I think perhaps that's maybe why I didn't push for it to actually end up on the album. That's why it was on the demo of the album, which was First Light, as you described. So, you know, it's probably one of my really early attempts at writing songs. And it's kind of charming, you know. It's very naive, I mean, and that's where the charm is. But certainly the guitar lines on it are, that's a real glimpse into my early style of guitar playing, you know, this frenetic vibrato that I had. And I think I'm playing something like a homemade guitar at the time. I don't know, because that's what I used to carry around with me. The tone of the guitar and the bass line is, you can really hear the striving in the guitar playing and the music. I mean, Steve Upton, you know, is playing way too many fills. And that's what we all did. And that's what drummers did in the 60s, actually. They played fills everywhere. If you listen to Mitch Mitchell or you listen to early Steve Upton, you know, they're doing fills all the time. You know, we just didn't care. We were just trying to get some licks in and trying to hone our craft. And so, you know, it's got this charming naivety, both lyrically, also in this choir-like angelic little voice I'm putting out.
So that is actually you singing. I thought that was Ted for some reason. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, you can hear all of the elements of the way the band came. And that song's kind of important to check out the roots, you know. And it's one of my sort of famous themes, you know, where I'm always kind of beating myself up in a song, you know. I've got my closet philosopher hat on and I'm talking about, you know, how, you know, the roads of day to day are not so bad, you know. You know, because I'm going through this big transition. I'm being wrenched away from my hometown, I'm being wrenched away from my relationship. I'm just freshly, newly left home, and I'm just trying to grapple with living in London again. And it's like, you know, I'm in turmoil. You can hear it. It's all there in the song.
Sing a dance. Thank you.
right. So this was the longest one so far. It's going on 6 minutes, which is not crazy for, you know, a semi-prog song, but it's just mostly the soloing at the end goes on for quite a while. That the song is basically over by 3 minutes. And it could just end like Me and I Am Dead. It could just stop there. But then it has this weird, I wasn't even sure if that was, because I watched you then playing this more recent 2007 live version. And the solo there is quite different than what's on here. You've got this weird, very low range with a heap of reverb. That's still you playing that, right?
We used to use reverb units on stage. We didn't have delay. We didn't have really effects. We just would crank the amps up and yeah. Often we would be developing the song in the studio. We often were encouraged to jam out to see whether, you know, things could be edited. And back in those days, of course, you'd edit the tape. But I think we just let it run. The way we recorded around that period of time, this was the first attempt at recording as a band. We literally just would go in and play live in the studio. I mean, you know, it was the same thing for all of the first two albums, at least, and this one, which was the precursor of the first album. And, you know, you went to the recording session and you just played and your music went down on its own dedicated track, 4-track or later on 8-track. And it wasn't until we recorded the Argus album that we went to 16-track, which was Quantum Leap forward. So, you know, you had to get it right and the engineer would be there and, record it. And what went down, you know, warts and all.
For this kind of thing, I don't want to put you on the spot and remember what happened in 1970, but like how much rehearsing would go into this, you know, either beforehand or at the time in the studio? Would this be just like, this is the take that got recorded, or are there?
I don't think with a song like this, we would have done much rehearsing.
Okay.
To be honest with you, because it was perceived as a song and we would have probably sat around and say and verbalized how we wanted it to be. We would have run it down a couple of times in rehearsal and then, you know, the recording session would have been how the song develops and what it became at that moment in time. But this was one of those songs, you know, we would say, hey, let's just do, you know, a verse, chorus, bridge, and then we'll do a long tail out solo and see what develops there. And we might verbalize these rhythmic shifts that we're going to do in that outro. And then we would just proceed to actually attempt to play them. And that would have been how this particular song would have come about.
Well, and that's what I was wondering about the dual lead. So the intro, that riff is simple enough that you could just go da 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 da, you know, be playing that. And then Ted would see that and, okay, I can play, you know, a third above that or try a couple things and there you go. Or would you have just, I already know what the two notes are and I'm going to tell you what the second note is?
I think we would have rehearsed those lines for sure. Yeah, I think we would have kind of rehearsed and composed those. I probably had the first part of the riff and we were writing from the limited amount of technique that we had at the time. You would know the basics of hammering and bending and it incorporate that into the guitar line. And, you know, it might be a kind of guitar line that you might play frequently in an improvised section in a song. And then if you sort of just pull it out of there and examine it with under the tweezers and just refine it and then add a harmony to it, that would have been how that riff occurs in the song would have come about.
Well, I always wonder when prog bands are doing their things, and this is sort of just the sort of the very first step if you were learning how to write prog or something, is like, okay, this kind of line, but that line is still simple enough that I could retain it in my head and, you know, remember from moment to moment that it's different. Now I could just record the little bit on my phone or whatever, I guess. But especially if you're working in a group setting, geez, I don't know how many times with my last band, I'd be playing bass and get my guitarist like, okay, let's work out a little thing for this section, work out a transition that we're going to double each other. We're going to play together. And then by the next time we get together, it's gone. Like you can't build a giant edifice of, you know, a composed thing if you don't have a way of capturing these things at the moment, either because your minds are just so in sync and it's a steel trap and you're going to be able to remember what this exact solo or this exact fairly intricate riff. Like I'm more thinking like a riff of the intricacy of the first song of American Century. I mean, at this point, I assume it's just you have little recording devices, so you don't forget stuff, or were you actually writing things on paper?
In point of fact, this is what you've got to kind of imagine, right? Well, I understand what you've just described, and that is probably more of a problem of us as we are now, or myself. I'm now hugely distracted. Everybody is distracted by, you know, we all have these short attention spans, and we don't bother retaining things. I was in an Irish bar a couple of years ago, somewhere in the countryside in Ireland, and we'd all had a few drinks. And people at the bar, one by one, would take turns in reciting poetry. And it just struck me that we don't do that in so-called civilized societies anymore. No one flexes their memory muscle because, you know, some device will record it. Well, think about this. Back in 69, we didn't even have a tape machine in the rehearsal studio. And what we did, I mean, we were embarking on a mystical journey. I mean, we left home. We were literally surviving on our wits. No money whatsoever. We had no backup, no support system other than the fact we had the squats, we called them, that we lived in. And I mean, we were just literally thieving food to live on. And we were going to this rehearsal room, which is our manager's house, every day. He wasn't feeding us. We were literally starving, actually. So it was literally life or death to retain this stuff. And you would play something and someone would go, that's it. That's a great line right there. That little line you're playing for this song, Rose of the Day, remember that. And you would remember it because your life actually depended on it. And you would perhaps go home at night and just reinforce it, play it a few times at home. But we didn't have any tape machines around. I mean, we didn't have an iPhone. We didn't have anything to record these ideas or whatever. But you would put so much heart and soul into that little line. That was the currency that you were bringing to the table the next day. So it was hugely important. And we invested so much emotion and thought and preciousness into these little melodic lines. And you were flexing your memory muscle. I mean, people don't do that anymore. Everything's transient. You know, it just goes by. And that was how precious our music was to us. It was the very currency that we were trading every day. Does that make sense?
I guess it's kind of like recording, if you're choreographing a dance, that there's no good way to write down. Maybe there are. Maybe I'm not a dance professional. Maybe there are good ways to write down, capture in some notation what your body was doing there, but probably not. Probably it's just kinesthetic and you just do it.
Well, we could have written it down, but it was also important to retain in your mind the impetus and the emotion that you were trying to create in these little riffs. And, you know, there's a certain yearning in the music of Wishbone. There's a certain yearning in the music of a lot of bands. Yeah, there's this feeling of like, notice me, listen to me, or I need to get this across, whether it's with a lyric or a vocal line or particularly a guitar line. And if you listen to guitar players back in the day, they were always trying to impart some kind of emotion. I think the best guitar players still do that, but they're fewer and far between. I mean, I get these guitar magazines and I see all these YouTube videos and I see people teaching people on YouTube, and so much of it is just actually what I would call interference. You know, it's just ear candy. We can do this. We can show you how this was done. But in the day, it was how that was how you got noticed. You know, it was very important that you'd have your own guitar tone or your own guitar technique. And it wasn't dependent on pedals or these little gizmos and toys and devices. It was like, what are you trying to say with your heart? And, you know, and that would come out in the guitar playing. And it was important as a guitar player that you had your own stamp. And the great thing about Wishbone Ash was we had two guitar players and we could have our own individual stamps, but we also had this sound that we created together, Ted Turner and myself, which was almost like a secret weapon that you could pull out and you could just arrest people's concert. You know, you could arrest their hearing and make them sit up and go, wow, that's actually a new sound. That's not just two guitar players playing there. It's like, I mean, I had a guy once, he ran a fan club for us in the States. He would come along and he'd say, first time he ever heard Wishbone Ash, it reminded him of dueling gypsies playing music. That was the only way he could describe it. And, you know, that really sort of warmed the cockles of my heart, really, because it was like, that was exactly what we were kind of trying to do. We were trying to create our own sound. We were pleading with the people to listen to it and to get it. And I think that that's something that I think is often missed now, because you weren't even allowed to gravitate to electric guitar until you could get something out of an acoustic guitar, or you weren't allowed to be a lead guitar player until you could at least play some rhythm. And I think that that's where we come out of. That's the tradition that Ted and myself come out of, that kind of tradition of playing guitar. You were really allowed to then do this. And then once you were allowed to do that, you had your own sound and you had to develop your own signature sound. Yeah, that's the only way I can describe it.
Well, my favorite part of the song is not the intro riff, though I like that a lot, but is right after the chorus where you have this little Spanishy part where the backgrounds are just going, what, F, G, A minor, do ga do ga do, do ga do ga do, and you have... That first note, which I believe is just, it's a D over an F chord, so it's a sixth. It's not something really crazy, but it just pushes outside the expected. I guess I'm kind of surprised that there's not more of those slightly blue notes in the solo. That the solo is pretty much just in the blues scale, at least until you get to the very end.
I was quite well known for, there's a friend of mine, Pat McManus, and he always sort of describes my guitar playing. He said, you were never afraid to kind of go out of the scale and bring in these kind of very individual guitar lines, which, as you just described, they're not complicated, but they're brave. That's what I actually like about my approach to guitar. You know, I never knew what I was doing half the time, but I wasn't afraid to get melodic with the guitar lines and stray way out the outer boundaries of the chord sequence, you know. And that's me. That's my style. That's my way of playing music. Just take huge chances, you know.
How unusual would it be at the time, the way that you resolve this solo, you're playing a blues scale thing, you know, very low for most of it. Finally, you get a little bit up the neck a little bit, and then you just go on one note that you're just, which is reminds me very much of some of the later Fleetwood Mac stuff, like the Big Love, the way that song ends. How would one normally end a jam like that?
I mean, Fleetwood Mac's another band where the guitar players, Peter Green, Danny Kirwan, mm-hmm. they had that kind of yearning thing about them, you know, in their technique and the way they approach guitar, and certainly huge influences on myself. You know, I mean, I saw Fleetwood Mac's first gig ever. I mean, I jumped up on stage and pulled Peter Green back on for an encore, you know, physically. And I was only like 17 at the time. And there's no question in my mind that Peter Green was probably the greatest white blues guitar player that ever came out of Britain. I mean, Eric Clapton included, who I love. But Peter just had this, it was this do or die thing. You know, in fact, he almost went over the precipice for his music. You know, I mean, he rescinded all worldly goods when he started to get fame. It wasn't the point of what he was doing. And he had that kind of mystical thing about him. And I certainly picked up on that, you know, and I certainly realized that if I was going to be privileged enough to pick up a guitar, then I better be saying something. It was just whatever you could scrape out of the thing, you know, but scraping at the strings, what could you? Sometimes you'd hang out on one note and that note would just resonate with the pickup and the body of the guitar. You know, that's why you weren't afraid to hang out on that note, because it kind of felt good to do that. You might overanalyze that these days and go, that's a bit of a cop-out, or we were like, nah, let's give it some more of that. Ring that neck, you know, give it a little bit more and more.
Or at least if I'm going to play the one note, I have to turn on the pedal that will then make the one note swirl into some magical whirling mist.
Yeah, definitely.
Speaking of Fleetwood Mac, I mean, the vocals on this, I'm glad to hear that that's actually you. I guess I didn't realize you had such a nice, high, beautiful, childlike voice at the time. And, but it does very much remind me of like the Danny Kirwan or, you know, some of the early Fleetwood Mac stuff as well.
It's a high tenor. Yeah, it's a very youthful voice. I mean, you know, you're talking about a voice that the voice only broke a couple of years earlier, and it's very youthful and angelic and pleading. And that's just me singing naturally. And I think I kind of shocked myself on that song. And it took me a couple of years to kind of come back to singing, because certainly solo, because I was a bit too bare. So bearing the soul a little too much from, I got kind of a little bit, if you like, inhibited. Plus being a guitar player, don't forget, you could always fall back on playing guitar, you know, because most guitar players, you know, they pick up the guitar rather than sing. It's a way of, you're almost vocalizing with your instrument, and it's a way to actually avoid singing. I don't think it's the same with bass players. You know, I think a bass player, because there's a great tradition of English bass players who were singers, you know, from McCartney to Sting to Martin Turner to John Wetton, you name it. I mean, and it's actually...
Well, there's a lot of Jack Bruce in the tone of the vocals as well, and all of you guys.
Well, my Jack Bruce, I had it, I forget him. I mean, he's the king. I mean, but guitar players could always say what they wanted to say with the guitar.
So speaking of the looking back at old lyrics, I guess it doesn't matter that you're saying passing the depth of dark despair, that, you know, that has this kind of, because it has this fairy tale telling like tone to it, that it's not like the previous song, like Master of Disguise, where it's more directly delivered, you know, as if you could sing it. It's that you're entering into this sort of medieval persona here. So it's like, it's okay if the lyrics are a little stilted and weird, because that's what it's supposed to be here.
Well, you know, I hadn't been to America at that point, I don't think. I'm a grammar school boy that did English literature And I'm just coming out of that. I'm literally 1 year away from leaving school. So, you know, I haven't come to America. I haven't actually got to the point where I recognize the economy of language, which is part of the American way of communicating. I got pretensions of being a poet there, you know. And, you know, it's that what we call sixth form lyrics, really. You know, you go to the sixth form, which is your final form, is another word in grammar school for class. It's your final class, you know, and I'm coming out of that. None of those other influences that later came to bear on a song like Master of Disguise, which came about like maybe 4 or 5 years later, they haven't been brought to bear yet. So I'm fresh out of the egg. I'm a little fledgling sparrow coming out of the nest, getting into a recording studio with a homemade guitar. I mean, that's me at that point.
Although it is interesting, just the mixture of the kind of very English twee fairy tale kind of with the jazzy underpinnings of this. That's just that, you know, you were mentioning Steve's crazy drum fills everywhere. There's also the bass slips into kind of a disco at some of the places. Boom, bap, boom, bap.
We hadn't fully become a band at that point. I mean, Steve Upton was a jazzy drummer. No question about it. So that would have come from him. And Martin would have been listening to lots of classical music. I mean, we had yet to refine our band sound. So you can hear on that album, which we later in retrospect called First Light. I mean, it literally is us just peeping over the parapet and saying, I think we could become a band. But we weren't really a band at that point. We were forming a band. We were melding our sound together and we were seeing what things worked and what things didn't work. And the rhythm section had actually been together for a number of years in previous band. So they were quite used to playing together. But certainly the guitars were trying to refine and hone a style that would become very familiar and which now fits like the proverbial glove. So, you know, we're trying to make a band. We had to form a band. We had people say, oh, you know, Wishbone Ash was formed out of an old band. It was out of the ashes of another band from the West Country called the Empty Vessels. But, you know, Wishbone Ash very, very definitely took a year to become a band. And that was just intensive, just hanging out a lot, learning each other's humor, learning each other's personalities, accommodating each other's personalities, both musical and the physical personalities of the people. And that takes a long time. But we just did a massive, it was like boot camp. We did a crash course in getting to understand who we were and how we could present ourselves as a band and policing ourselves. You know, it's like, you can do that, but you can't do this. You can wear that, but you can't wear that. It was like, you can play this, but you better not play that. And, you know, one of the things that's often overlooked with Wishbone Ash is we were a harmony guitar band, twin lead guitar band. We still are. But a big signature part of the sound that made us successful, particularly it all came together on the third album, was the harmonized vocals, which a lot of Californian bands did quite naturally. You know, Jefferson Airplane, people like that. I mean, Grateful Dead, they would sing these vocal lines and there would be two guys harmonizing. Well, we very much homed in on that and we brought it all together really on Argus. And that's where I think that a lot of people loved about the sound of the band was this melody. But there was not only melody in the guitar playing, it was melody in the vocalizing. And it was later that, to our detriment, that we abandoned that. And I think that that was the ear candy that everyone was looking for, that harmonized vocals and harmonized guitars. So, you know, it became a very big sound, a very grand sound that was a result of exploring those two avenues.
Those other bands you mentioned, you know, they all have at least one person or maybe more than one person who just sings, that they were brought in for the purpose, that the fact that you have people furiously playing instruments who still, 3 out of 4 of you, by luck, can sing well enough that you can lock in like that. I mean, was that a big learning curve there in terms of...
I don't think we really thought about it. I just thought we've come together as a band. We've got the musical instruments to work out. And I just thought we were all about expanding the parameters of everything that we had going on. It's like a guitar player using, instead of just using 2 fingers on his left hand, he uses all 4. And I mean, it's quite common now with guitar players, you know, they'll use at least, you know, all the fingers on the right hand as well. They're plucking, they're picking, they're doing everything, you know, and I mean, it was the same thing with us. We just have to create synergy. We have to pull the most music out of everything we've got going on here. You know, fingers, toes, arms, legs, voices, you know.
So did you try to make Steve sing too? Is that...
No, Steve actually got away with that one. But he did write lyrics,
you know,
for us. And so, you know, we were using it, you know, it wasn't enough just to be the drummer or the guitar player. You had to bring something else to the table because, you know, we were a band and that's what was expected of a band. We didn't even question it. It's just like, well, you know, you used all of your musical faculties and it was just demanded and it was required and it was expected. And that was what being in Wishbone Ash was all about. It was like, you better not flake for 1 minute here. You can't get away with... You've got to be on. If we got together as a band in a rehearsal room, you were on 150%. You know, you couldn't skulk in the corner and just like twiddle around on the guitar and think you could get away with that. You had to think about vocal melodies. You had to verbalize or sing guitar melodies, which would then be transposed onto the guitar. And, you had to step up to the plate, as they say.
Well, I guess there's always a difference between people who sing harmonies because they just love to sing and people that might have perfectly good voices, but that they don't really jump in with something unless you kind of pitch it to them. Like, now we're going to do a three part here.
But I think that comes back to what I was saying earlier, where our very life depended on, at the end of the day, we had to produce something, you know, and I think that if you couldn't get it out of a guitar, you would hum it to somebody. If you couldn't complete a lyric, then someone else in the band would complete it for you. The main thing was to be productive. And at the end of a day's rehearsal, you better have something finished because we had a deadline. We had to prepare a band for touring. We had to try and get a record deal. We had to survive. We had to pay the rent. And so it's really, and I think that was, you know, the ethos behind a band like the Beatles. I mean, for sure. You know, I don't think it was the same in other bands, like, for example, The Who. You know, Pete Townsend was a primary writer, but everyone had to actually sort of flesh the music out, though, and give it attitude, big attitude. And, but, you know, I think with Wishbone Ash, I mean, it was all hands on deck, most definitely.
So it sounds like in terms of getting your ego out of the way and we're just going to, like, for instance, with lyrics, make sure this thing is as good as possible. So if I need to bring in my friend to add lyrics or somebody, or we're going to just, that you've retained that at least as a goal from the beginning of the band to the end. It's just that it's a very different atmosphere now where it's kind of convivially, you know, now you're all old enough. You're not going to take it as personally as opposed to.
Yeah, but there's still very much, and this is my responsibility with the band as it is now, because now we're talking about a band that's had like 28, 29 different people through it. I'm very much, as I said in the beginning of the podcast, I'm the keeper of the flame. I know, I've got the DNA. I can go back and I can remember what it was like to work to that intensity and that degree and to staff. I have the band ethos in me, you know. I know what it's like to staff, so I therefore feel very privileged to be able to make music. And when we get together, as we are right now, I mean, it's really literally, you know, eyes wide open. We're all looking into each other's eyes, and it's like, this is a really privileged thing that we're able to do here. And this is also contributing to the legacy of a band, a great band. And, you know, we better get it as good as we possibly can. And it better make people sit up and pay attention. You know, I'm still trying to get those tones out of the guitar. I'm still trying to wake myself up and trying to excite myself even now. You know, and if I didn't do that, and if I didn't feel it was still a work in progress, I actually just wouldn't be doing it. But I do get a massive kick out of it all, and I still do. And I think that, you know, you're always I think most good artists are really, they still feel they've got their best work in them, and they're still a work in progress, and they're always striving. They're yearning, they're striving, they're trying to achieve, and it doesn't matter how good you are. I mean, Paul McCartney, phenomenal songwriter. I know that he still sits down and tries to achieve stuff on the piano or the guitar or bass, and I know that when he's out on the road, he's still trying to be a better singer. I'm sure he is. Same with Sting, same with Paul Simon. Anyone you care to think of, they do it because they love it.
All right, so just for the last thing, let's have you introduce our final song, which is In Crisis, which is from the Power of Eternity album, 2007. So this is the first of the three albums to have your current lineup that has now been in place for quite a while. Do you want to say a little about this song, this project?
The guitar player that's been with the band for the last 12 years is Muddy Manon from Helsinki in Finland. And this was an example. He's actually just left the band, in point of fact. I'm updating you as we speak. And we have a brand new gentleman on guitar, Mark Abrahams. But Getting back to Muddy, or Jyrki as his Finnish name is, Jyrki Manninen. He and I, we got together in Helsinki. We literally hadn't worked together before, so we sat down across his kitchen table in his apartment. We just started writing. And this was one of the first things that came up. And I think I had the lyric written out.
That you said you wrote on the highway on a bag or something?
Yeah, literally on a fast food bag. And I was going through a personal crisis, and I was driving across the Delaware Bridge, and they have these illuminated signs that are specifically to stop jumpers. Now, I wasn't necessarily thinking about jumping off the bridge, but it shocked me because they said, "Are you in crisis?" And it was cool, this toll-free number. So I had the lyric, which was inspired on a journey home, I think, after a tour. I was driving the truck and the trailer back home to Connecticut, and all the guys, I think, had left. And they'd gone, you know, we'd just done a tour, and, I was going through a personal crisis. And we just sat down across the table from each other and started just playing. I had a few chords, a little bit. We just started jamming out, doing the process, the time-honored process that is the essence of Wishbone Ash. And we both started playing quite jazzy chords. Now, I'm not a jazz guitar player, but I just started coming up with these chords, and I kind of had an idea for the melody, and there it came. It just came out very easily. It's quite a complex song, actually, but we still play it, actually, on stage, and it's one of my favorites. And I thought it quite suited my vocal approach, which, as it's become these days, and yeah, I was really pretty happy with the way that song turned out.
And even though it's kind of I wouldn't say a ballad, but I noticed it's the closing track to the Tough, that you have two compilations, Tough and Tender. And this counts as Tough.
Oh, okay. Cool. Well, yeah, there's a toughness about it, that's for sure. It certainly also got plenty of room in it for some guitar soloing, which we were able to flex our muscles there in some way, you know, guitar-wise. And I think it was a great example of the beginning of a really pleasurable musical relationship that Muddy and I had. I'll look back with fondness on the albums that we created together. And it was a very creative period for the band in terms of the modern history. And now we're into another phase, which will probably be just as exciting, but in a different way, perhaps.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time. You have a lot to say about these things.
I must say, you got a lot of in-depth information out of me, which doesn't always come over. I normally don't go that deep, but it was a lot of pleasure for me, too, to revisit the songs and to think about the... In talking to you, I actually relived and rethought. I was rethinking what it was like to actually be in this band at the very early stages. And so thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Well, good. I mean, it's nice that you wrote the cheat sheet, that you wrote a whole book that I could read to get some background and figure out what was important and what was not. But I did notice in that it's unusual for, even though you write a lot in that, there's not a lot about sort of the mechanics of actually sitting down and doing this stuff. It seems like it's mostly a nonverbal or...
That's true. I mean, you know, I talk more about being in a band. I talk about the band history, but sometimes, you know, I wanted my book, Eyes Wide Open, to appeal to a broad range of fans. And there are not so many fans like yourself where you really get into the musicality side of it. They are into it, but they wouldn't perhaps want to see it notated in a book to that degree. So in that respect, this podcast is quite maybe an adjunct to the book, and perhaps in a later time I could get more into a blog or whatever from much more of a musical standpoint, if you will, and that might satisfy people such as yourself, you know. But I mean, in a book you've got to really have a broad, you can't get too deep. Because you've got so many aspects to touch upon, you know, in terms of being in a band. Well, good luck to you. I enjoyed it immensely.
Thank you so much.
Driving into Delaware, dealing with a daily grind. Of a war, she and I, you survived, but I can't take it anymore. I feel like walking out the door. Up in the sky, I see.
check to wonder why. Up in the sky I see a sign. Are you in Christ? It's called this line. We can ease your troubled mind. It takes a minute of your time. Up in the sky I see the sign. Are you in Christ? It's called this line. We can ease your troubled mind.
Take some little bit of your time.
man, that is exactly what I'm shooting for. For an artist like that who's been interviewed so many times, to find the approach of this podcast refreshing and enlivening, instead of having to talk about the lawsuit over the band's name, which if you look these up, is probably what you're going to find first the most information about. Like I said, Andy has been running this thing consistently for many years, whereas a lot of bands, they just break up, and then they have the luxury of 20 years later, hey, let's have a casual get-together, a reunion, and there's a lot of reasons why that has not really happened with this band. The original lineup did have a reunion at the end of the 80s, but then after that, some of the guys are not playing as often, whereas Andy's been honing his craft and getting people into the band who have been playing just as dedicatedly as he has been. But of course, if you're attached to the original albums, if you're attached to the original lineup, then as much as you might like Andy's recent thing, you might still really want to hear those original personalities. And you can hear that Andy really has a lot of reverence for what that thing was in the 70s, even as he maintains that his recent stuff is just as strong, is just as intelligently put together, just as passionate, just as artistic, not simply derivative from the earlier stuff. Anyway, it's a fascinating story, and I'm so grateful to Andy for talking to me, and also to Billy James at Glass Onion PR, who has put me in touch with many of my guests, going back to episode 3 with Kevin Godley. Again, if you want to learn more about what Wishbone Ash is doing these days, check out wishboneash.com. And if you want to hear more interviews like this, check out nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Now, as you may have guessed, these interviews take quite a bit of work to put together. Though I love every minute of my prep time, it would really help to know that folks out there appreciate what we're doing here. And one way you can show that is to go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic, make a small recurring contribution. Another thing you could do is go on Facebook. You can like Nakedly Examined Music there and share this episode, share other episodes that appeal to you so your friends can check out what we're doing here. You can also go to the iTunes store or Stitcher or wherever you listen to this and leave a nice review. Give us a good rating. That kind of thing always leads to a heightening of the profile of the podcast within the search rankings. But most of all, come back for next episode. Next one's going to be really interesting. Kim Rancourt, who's a New York punk fixture. Then I'll be talking to David Brookings, who in addition to being a brilliant, very melodic songwriter, recorded every single Beatles song, one per day on successive days for a long goddamn time. Then episode 54 will feature Khaki King, a brilliant guitarist, mostly instrumental work. Then Don Preston, keyboardist from Frank Zappa's Mothers of Invention and a brilliant composer himself. And most recently, I've now talked to Frank Portman. You may have heard the name of his longtime band, The Mr. T Experience, who is also quite a famous YA author at this point. He wrote the book King Dork and some follow-ups to that, so you could look him up. And there's more to come after that. If you know an artist that you'd like to hear me talk to, send the link to that person, or you can email me at mark@nakedlyexaminedmusic.com and make some suggestions. You can suggest yourself. So keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Lintonmeyer, signing off.